Chapter 2. Itali stood at a window of a house on Fontamana Street, watching the moon rise over old gardens dim with evening, and hearing the lilt of the fountain below the window as the west wind sprang up and moved in the leaves in the dusk. He was dressed in a plum-coloured coat, his mother's Christmas gift. His linen was fine and well-starched. His hair was orderly. His cravat and stickpin were controlled. His face was quiet and a little forlorn. He was wondering if looking south from here on a clear day, you could see the mountains. "Never saw a chap look out of windows as much as you do," said Enrique Paludesca, entering the room after a feeble rap. "What do you see out of 'em, Sordi? Roofs, trees, moon, nothing going on. Same view I've got. Are you ready?" "Yes," said Itali, turning his forlorn look to Enrique's heavy, well-shaven, good-natured face. "How do you like me rig? English fashion. Everything has to be English. I don't know why. Come on. Louisa's waiting. What's the time? These damn trousers are so tight, I can't get my watch out without performing a sort of dance. It mustn't be late. The old lady's a dragon." Itali looked at his watch, which said 2:30. It had stopped running several weeks ago, and he kept meaning to have it fixed. "Must be near 6. We had better drive, then." Louisa smiled up at them from the foot of the broad staircase. "Don't be silly, Harry. It's only around the corner. Town's all squeezed up together," Enrique grumbled. "Hate arriving on foot." But on foot they set off into the evening of early spring. The fountain sang. The budding branches of the plane trees interlaced above the street. The wind was soft and cool. The moon poised bright above the roofs. All things were poised in balance. All things here, Itali thought, were in harmony. They were to dine with one of the inmost circle of Isna society, the Marchioness Feldesca Torm. Itali was well received. They knew who he was. A landowner's son of Val Marafrena, one of the Western Domei, a house guest of one of themselves, therefore, temporarily, one of themselves. Evidently, they also knew what else he was. For after supper, the Marchioness, a small, plain old woman, said pleasantly to him, "Well, Mr. Sordi, are you bringing the revolution to Isna? I should have thought we were scarcely worth fomenting." There seemed no point in hedging. "No, Marchesa," he said. "I'm only trying to lure some of your young men away to Krasnoy." "You city people always want the revolutions all to yourselves," the old lady said with a ghostly laugh. "I've read many of your articles, Mr. Sordi. They're interesting, eloquent." He bowed in thanks. "They remind me sometimes of what our Valtura used to write for the old Isna Mercury, and of Constant Veloy in the Krasnoy Review. Then I think Veloy has been dead for 20 years. Valtura has been in prison in Austria for 10. I suppose he's dead too. 4 generations of radicals I've seen, Mr. Sordi. I haven't seen the revolution." The challenge was direct, and he answered it directly. "I believe you will see it, Marchesa." "You keep trying, I grant you that. I see you've won over our handsome baroness." She looked at Louisa, who was talking politics with Mr. Belenin, Anna Feldesca Torm, great-nephew. "I doubt Valtura could have done that, if he'd had the chance. But he wouldn't have had the chance, she said, looking at him with shrewd, cold eyes. He left the pleasant dinner party, somewhat depressed in spirit. The Marchioness had placed several darts in him with exquisite accuracy. She had reminded him that his cause had been defeated time and time again. She had reminded him that the Paludescas were very curious companions for a revolutionary. She had reminded him of the ambiguity of his own position. And yet, she had done all this not, he admitted, in enmity to his cause, but in support of it. She had as good as asked, "Where is our revolution? What are you doing about it?" He walked restlessly about his room in the Ariosko house, then went to the window that overlooked the garden, opened it, and leaned out. The fountain lilted in its stone basin, a thin, silvery sound in the night. A fountain in the street, crossing a few doors down, interwove a faint counterpoint. The wind was down. It was profoundly still, the stillness of the long fields that stretched on from the city on every side. A few stars burned humidly bright in the sky, washed with moonlight. Beauty, balance, harmony. Sick of himself, Itali tried to lose himself in the moonlight, the quiet, but could not. In this germinant darkness, this moment between March and April, between sleep and wakening, he found only anger, uncertainty, and fear. Turned back upon himself, he tried to face himself, demanding the source of the trouble. When had his work become not an end, but a mere distraction from, or means towards, some different and obscurer end? What necessity was he shirking? With what angel must he wrestle? In asking the questions, it seemed to him the trouble lay in his presence here now in this house. All his uncertainties of the last months might clarify themselves if he could simply answer the question, "What am I doing here?" His mind veered at once from the question, replacing it with a different one, the question others might ask of him. Enrique, for instance, did he wonder occasionally why Itali was with him in Aesna? If so, he gave no sign of it. He had known Itali on and off for a year and a half now, at his own house and at the Hellasca house, and probably assumed that anyone he had known so long had to be a friend. Their brief, warm flare of companionship on the coach was long forgotten. They never had a conversation of any consequence whatever since. Enrique simply took Itali for granted, and his hosts here, the Arioscars, but this was no good. He came, presented as the Paludesca's friend and a gentleman, and naturally they accepted him as such. Why not admit that he felt at home with them, in this comfortable, quiet house, as he never felt at home in his two cold rooms in Krasnoy, eating bread and cheese by himself, and listening to the endless thud of Kune's loom. But that was no good either. The matter of comfort was irrelevant. The question of his right to be here, no question. The point was, what was he doing here? Was this one of the places to which he had to come, as Krasnoy was? Again, his mind sheared off from the matter, asking with self-pity if he might not have a little comfort and good company now. and then, while he did what he had to do. But what it was he had to do, he did not know. Leaning out of the window, he gazed southward over the rooftops, straining his eyes as if he looked for something real and present beyond the moonlit wash of air. His mind was quite empty. He said aloud, "Why am I wasting my time?" He drew back, thinking he'd seen a movement, someone looking up in the darkness under the trees. The air inside the room was close. He loosened his high stock, began to take off his coat, then shrugged it back on and, with a cautious, decisive step, left the room. Went down the hall, down the stairs, through the music room, and out of the side door of the house, into the garden. There, all was luminous and cool. The fountain sang. The stars gleamed through budding branches. Rows of narcissus by the paths gleamed in the moonlight, and the warmer glow of the few lighted windows of the house. Itali walked to the fountain and stood watching the play of the water, then sat down on a bench near it, his hands in his pockets, his eyes still on the slender jet of water that seemed to hang suspended over the basin, catching the moonlight, falling and renewing in one motion, constant change in changelessness, alive. Itali. He got up quickly. "It's hot in the house. I can't bear it. I can never sleep in spring." Her voice was no louder than the sound of the fountain. She had thrown a shawl over her light dress, and in the broken light and shade of the garden, nothing of her was clear but her face, simplified by that mixed light into simple beauty. "I've wanted to talk to you ever since you came. There's never a moment. Are you content, Itali? Are you content with what you're doing?" "I wouldn't be doing anything else." "But is your life what you want it to be?" "No," he said, and moved restlessly, clasping his hands behind his back. Louisa sat down on the bench, drawing the shawl around her shoulders. "If you were free, no responsibilities, no duties, entirely free, what would you do?" "I can't imagine freedom without responsibility." "Oh, bah," she said. "How stuffy you can be, and how it helps you evade answering. If you were free to do exactly what you wanted to do, what would you do?" In her voice was an impertinent tenderness, a note he never heard before, and that struck him as her true note, herself speaking without defense, nervous, mocking intent. "I don't know," he said. "I'd go home." "Where is home?" "Malafrena. But the fact is I'm doing what I want to do." "Your idea of freedom is a child's idea, Baronina." "Probably. Women are all childlike, aren't they? And spiritual too, of course. Perhaps my idea of freedom is spiritual. A bit ghostly. Choice without consequence. Well, I know what I would do if I were free, like a child or a ghost. I would do very nearly what I do now." "Then you are happy?" "Very nearly happy." He had turned to face her, wanting to see her face, which was in shadow now. "I imagine that only moral people, like you, are very happy or unhappy," she said. "I'm always both, and most of all on spring nights when I can't sleep, and have to walk in the garden, wondering what on earth would ever make me happy without making me unhappy. There's no reason why you should be unhappy. None at all, I know. I'm young and rich and very well dressed. In any case, I'm a woman. It takes very little to make a woman happy. A toy or two, a necklace, or a fan. I did not mean that, Itali said stiffly. What did you mean? He did not reply for a while. When he did, his tone was low and unwilling, without warmth. I meant, I don't want you to be unhappy. I know that. You want me to be happy. You want to think me as happy because it's so much pleasanter and easier. If you think of me as unhappy, then you have to do something about it. Find a toy to amuse me. If you are a friend, of course. You know I am your friend, Baronina. Don't call me Baronina. It's a stupid title. I suppose you believe all titles are stupid. Ours certainly is. I wish my grandfather had had the courage to appear as what he was, the best of his class. I should be proud to be a haute bourgeoise, nothing more and nothing less. But he had to buy us into the nobility and leave us clinging tooth and nail to the lowest rung of the rotten old ladder leading nowhere, pretending that it isn't money that made us and makes us and will take us wherever we go. She looked up at Itali and laughed suddenly, a laugh of real amusement. Oh, God, Itali, you are infectious. Lectures in the moonlight. Do I lecture? Almost continually. I'm sorry, he said, chagrined. I don't mind. I like your lectures. At least they're serious. At least you talk seriously to me. Though whether you're talking to me, I often wonder. But at least you allow me to be present while you talk. Some day, perhaps, you will, in fact, talk to me. I don't... No, I know you don't. You never have. I don't know what you mean. I mean that under all the theories, the politics, the lectures, there is silence. A granite silence, unbroken. No, I take that back. I think you said something to me just a minute ago. It took me so by surprise that I almost missed it. You said that you loved, but no, you didn't say it after all, now I think of it. I could simply hear in the way you said the name that you were finally taking or talking about something to me, something real, not an idea, not a theory. What name? Malafrena. He half turned away again towards the fountain, his hands deep in his pockets, and shrugged. I miss it sometimes, he said. She said nothing, watching him. It isn't far from here. He looked up as if he wanted to say more, but he did not say any more. She continued to watch him, the tall, hunched figure in front of her, the profile, big nose, mouth firmly closed, a portrait in charcoal, plain and strong. A few streets away, the half-hour struck on the bells of Aesna Cathedral. A faint wind had come up, moving the leaves, making the air feel chill. In the house behind them, a light went off silently, leaving the path they were on and the flowers beside it cold white. Though you don't talk to me, you talk to yourself sometimes. When? At your window, a few minutes ago, you said, why am I wasting my time? That's why I asked you if you were happy, knowing that you weren't. She spoke very low in the silence after the bells. I don't know what I meant. It's almost frightening to hear someone say the very words you're thinking, but not say them to you. I wasn't talking about anything particular. She stood up. I hate to watch men lie, she said, her voice a little more distinct. I hate anything done clumsily. But if you're not interested in the truth, why should I be? She turned to go. Her shawl had slipped from her shoulders and lay in a pool of silken white on the path. He picked it up. She had stopped at his movement. He set the shawl on her shoulders. As he did so, she turned towards him and reached up, taking his right hand, the delicate film of silk between their hands. They stood a moment, motionless. Louisa. Itali, she mocked him, that discordant tenderness in her tone. He bent to kiss her mouth, the warm silk slipping beneath his hand, and she slipped away, broke from him, and turned to him again at a little distance. Her face was smooth as a bright mask. Her eyes were exultant and terrified. "Good night," she whispered, and slipped away into the shadow, into the open door of the house. Itali stood there a while, and then walked under the trees where he had seen her first. He came to the wall of the garden. He put his hands on it, then leaned against it, his forehead on his arm. For a minute, he was intensely aware of himself, felt the rough brick against his palm, smelt the extreme sweetness of the narcissus blooming at his feet, saw the late, serene night around him. Then it all slid away again, and again returned, as if he were swimming in an invisible sea, warm, tumultuous, silent, from which he broke free long enough to breathe, feel his heart pounding, see the stars. Then he went under again. When the cathedral bell struck three, he turned slowly round and made his way to the house. He lay down on his bed, fully dressed, and immediately, as if knocked out, went to sleep. Next day, he went about the business that had brought him to Aesna, if it was business that had brought him to Aesna. He did not consider the question. He considered nothing that was not directly under his nose. As soon as one conference or conversation was over, he forgot it and went on to the next. He was, if anything, more decisive and efficient than usual. But at any given hour, he could not have said without an effort of thought what he'd been doing an hour earlier, or perhaps what he was doing now. One person he met broke through his insulation. An Italian, exiled for his part in the Piedmont revolt of 1820. He'd spent a year in Aesna, and was about to set off for England. Something in this man reached Itali, and afterwards he recalled vividly San Giusto's long face, high forehead, curly hair, his cordial voice, as they sat at a cafe table in the leaf-dappled late sunlight on Fontomana Street. A liberal is a man who says the means justify the end, he said. And the words, too, stayed with Itali. The light got lower, dustier, more golden down the tree-arched street. A few carriages rolled by slowly. The wind smelled of ploughed fields, and the moon rose over the old houses. Itali went back to supper with his hosts. Louisa's cousin was a cold, shy woman, and Ariosca had little conversation in him. Enrique was dining elsewhere. Louisa, whose manners were as good as she wanted them to be, kept up just enough talk that no one felt awkward, to the evident gratitude of the Ariostas. Coffee was served upstairs at 10, and at 10:15 the evening ended. It was now Holy Week. There would be no more parties until Easter was past. Back in his room, Itali did not open the window or look out of it. He took off his coat, sat down at the escritoire, and began going through a pile of local and foreign pamphlets and manuscripts he had gathered in the course of the day. He read steadily, annotating occasionally, never raising his head. The room was bright with candles, but chilly, as he had let the little fire go out. The bell of the cathedral, a soft, deliberate baritone, struck midnight. Itali hunched his shoulders and went on reading. "There must be no confusion," said the pamphlet, "of such manifestations of radicalism as the secret societies of France, Italy, and the Germanies, nor such excesses of radical opinion as the revolutionary leagues of the last decade in England. But the liberal faction in our country, which the government of Orsinia not only tolerates, but will indubitably come to favour as a benign and harmless indication of peaceful popular enlightenment. To forbid the publication of..." Itali went back and crossed out the word faction, crossed out indubitably, scowled, and crossed out the entire sentence, then put the thing aside and put his head in his hands. He got up, went about the room, putting out the candles, took up his coat, went downstairs and out. The air was colder tonight. The moon, a night past full, was veiled by a slight mist. The jet of the fountain blew astray now and again in the slight breeze. Itali stood by the stone bench, looking at the narcissus blooming at his feet. He heard the latch of the house door. Louisa came to him, a long dark scarf wrapped about her over her light dress. "I heard you," she whispered with a laugh in her voice. "I was listening for you. Baronina." "Dom Ital," she mocked. "I cannot call you Louisa." She sat down on the stone bench, drawing the dark, voluminous scarf up about her neck, smoothing the fall of it across her skirt. "And what else can you not do?" "You are unjust," he said. "Am I? But then I'm only a woman. No one expects justice from a woman. As you can't call me by my name, so I can't treat you with justice." "You are unjust to yourself." "Am I?" she said again, but without anger, thoughtfully. "I wonder. You may be right." She looked up at him with so direct a gaze that he could not turn from it. "You have the power to hurt me. How strange that is." "I have no wish to hurt you. Don't you understand?" "No. I have no power to... You know what I am," he said desperately, "and how I live and where I live." "What of it?" He could not answer. "I'm not asking you for manners. I'm not asking you for mercy. I'm asking you for the truth, to speak to me, just once to speak to me." "What can I say?" The fountain, blown aside by the wind, rustled and pattered. "What good would it do if I said it?" he said in anguish. "None," Louisa whispered. "None." She rocked herself a little, holding her arms about her sides, drawn into herself. "All we can do is hurt each other. It's no good." She rose suddenly, reaching out to him. His first response was startled and awkward, as her movement had been awkward. Then he held her to him more strongly. That inept embrace became searching. Her tension melted into yielding, fused towards him till they clung together, pressed together in an insatiable kiss. From it she broke at last, twisting away blindly, he reaching blindly after her. With control, a reaction of momentary shock and sickness came into him, and he sank down on the bench and sat bowed forward, his head down. She stood nearby. Her body trembled slightly from time to time. She watched him. When he looked up, he did not meet her eyes, but spoke to her arms in an angry, pleading whisper. "Don't you see? Do you see now? At last?" When he understood her, his expression began to change from dazed to dazzled. He stood up, and putting out his hands towards her in an uncertain gesture, said, incredulous and gentle, "Louisa." "Ah," she said, "there." She took his hands and held them, standing facing him, separate, smiling, her face raised. "I will be just," she whispered with that exulting smile. "I will be merciful." He could say nothing coherent, but stammered praise and desire. She took his arm and walked with him up and down the path and across the lawn to the garden wall and back to the fountain. Most of his consciousness was centered upon the warmth of her arm and her side and the warm, faint fragrance of her hair. He agreed without hesitation when she said, "Now we can choose. What I can't bear, what I can't bear is falseness, dishonesty, the stupid rules made for stupid people, the rules of lying. What I want is the truth, and only the truth." "I love you," he said. "We are not children, and not fools, and not slaves. We can choose what we do. That is what I want. That's all I want, the freedom to choose. Do you understand, Itali?" "Yes," he said, because she was so eager and intense, because she wanted freedom, happiness as he did, because the pressure of her arm on his made his head swim with happiness. "If you judge me now," she continued in her intense whisper, "I would despise you. But you won't. All you do, all your friends and their ideas, they're trivial. But you're above them, above all that. There's no freedom but what one makes oneself, for oneself." He agreed. "That's why we must choose Italy this week. I go back to Krasnoy Wednesday. You'll come a week later. That's enough time. We must each choose, both choose, what we wish to do. No one, and nothing forbidding us or compelling us. I will use my life and my love as I see fit to use it. We will set each other free, Itali." The tremor in her voice might be exultation or terror. He drew her to him and kissed her mouth. But as her lips softened against his, she began to draw away. He let her go. She whispered, "Only a week." But he realized she was going. She had gone, a glimmer between moonlight and darkness on the path. "Louisa," he said, "wait." The house door opened and shut quietly. He stood there by the fountain, bereft and confused. Why had she gone? Had he misunderstood again? Were they not lovers, or to be lovers? He'd understood her as she spoke of freedom. But now he did not know what she had said. A light glimmered faint behind the curtains in a room upstairs. Her candle, her bedroom. He sat down on the stone bench once more, shivering with cold and the aftershocks of frustrated desire, groping after the immense happiness he had felt only a minute before. A week, he repeated, finding the words a talisman. Only a week.